I'm Richard Brendan, and you're listening to Journey's Fire. You know, early in the past, people of all cultures have used stories to help them explain a practice, a belief, or even a natural phenomenon. It's a universal means of communicating cultural traditions and values, as well as a vehicle for passing on information about history, science, government, and even politics. Some stories are new, others have been handed down from the ancients. Regardless of the origin of stories, storytelling is unique and a dynamic interaction between the teller and the listener. I'm excited about my guest today, Antonia Sacre. Antonia has performed at the National Book Festival, at the Library of Congress, the Kennedy Center, the National Storytelling Festival, appeared on National Public Radio, and been the recipient of the ALA's Notable Award, the Parents' Choice Gold and Silver Awards, and the Ethnic Folk Arts Fellowship. Born in Boston to a Cuban father and an Irish-American mother, Sacre is an internationally touring storyteller, author, and solo performer based in Los Angeles. He is an amazing talent, and he's joining me from beautiful L.A. Antonia, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's really great to be on.
It's always great to have a storyteller on. I've noticed over the years, it seems like storytelling is gaining in popularity. As a matter of fact, TED Talks are popular everywhere, and they are here. But I've always enjoyed The Moth, because it seems like The Moth is more about storytelling as well, when people audition for that.
Oh, for sure. You know, storytelling is at the heart of everything. You know, when you hear about a great film, they say, oh, this is a really great story. Of course, novels, even songs, you know, and the fact that there's actually a greater sort of public awareness about it, The Moth has been great for that. You know, before, you know, I've been doing it for 30 years. When I first started, they're like, storytelling what? And if I say, well, kind of like The Moth, it's really helpful. And also all the stuff on NPR, This American Life and Snap Judgment, and, you know, those things are really great for just getting stories out there.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you're quite accomplished, and yet I was touched when I looked at your website, and it says, Antonia Sacre, the most successful storyteller you've never heard of. So that's refreshing, actually, because everyone else is shoving themselves in everybody's face. So you have a great sense of humor. I can tell by your voice you do, too. But can you give us, like, a brief overview of how in the world did you get into storytelling?
It's a great question, and in some ways it changes every time I answer it. The short answer is I was studying to be an actor. I was studying to be an actor in Chicago, where I was going to, you know, be a stage actor and look into film. And I took a storytelling class in graduate school at Northwestern almost as a lark. It didn't have any exams. There was no textbooks to worry about. All you needed to do was listen to stories and tell stories, and that felt like a great break for me. Turns out I ended up falling into what became a passion of mine. And I also, again, like back to being lucky or being at the right place at the right time, Chicago at the time was just a hotbed of this kind of storytelling.
Yeah.
And I was mentored by just phenomenal storytellers. I was in a scene where schools were paying to have storytellers come in, where the best were really just mentoring me. And as a matter of fact, Indianapolis and Indiana became the first place that I performed out of town. It was a big deal for me to be invited from Chicago to the big, you know, Indianapolis as the Hoosier Storytelling Festival. And it was really, you know, kind of, you know, it's just really that's part of it. Now, there is a national festival scene. There's the National Storytelling Festival in Jonesboro, Tennessee, which a lot of people put on their bucket list as a place to visit. And, you know, a lot of schools have seen the power of just the oral tradition. There are now studies that are saying that the oral tradition and just listening to stories helps kids learn how to read.
Yeah.
And so schools are seeing that, and they're, you know, we're fighting against all these devices, which are wonderful and amazing and help us get through traffic, but these devices are also sort of stopping the thing that we're built to do, which is to tell and listen to stories.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
You mentioned Chicago. Didn't you meet your wife in Chicago?
I did, as a matter of fact. So there's a famous, again, it's a little bit of an oxymoron in storytelling, but one of the biggest storytellers is a man named Jim May, and he was giving a storytelling workshop, which I still take workshops from anybody I can. And there was a woman there who was taking it. She was a preschool teacher, and she was talking about her daughter, and she said, you should come to my school and tell stories, and I did. And then years later, I met her daughter, so I became friends with my mother-in-law-to-be, best friends, in some ways, really good friends, and then I ended up meeting her daughter. But yeah, so my wife went to IU in Indiana. And her best friend got married at the Indiana, the Historical Society there. And,
yes.
So the Midwest connection is big for me.
It sounds like it. I remember there's a video on your website where you talk about, in a very hilarious way, how I think you were a puppeteer. And you met, you said you saw the love of your life, it was the first time, behind stage, right?
Yes.
Can you share that, please? That was beautiful.
Well, it's funny. So, you always think you're going to be in the proper position at the proper time. And I was covered in white pancake makeup, and I had these goggles on my head and this ridiculous outfit. And then she was there backstage and, wearing a crown of flowers in her hair, and it was just kind of stopped dead in my tracks there. Yeah, it was kind of amazing. Amazing moment.
So talk about the evolution of first of all, your career, and how has it unfolded over the years?
So the biggest thing that happened was in Chicago, mm-hmm. I was the only one that could tell stories in Spanish. My father's from Cuba, and my mom is Irish-American. Mm. And even though I didn't have the expertise or even the repertoire, I had a thing that nobody else had. And when I was living in Chicago, there was a huge need of kids who were just learning English. There were kids who were wanting to learn Spanish. So I fit this perfect niche market. And it led to, a career in children's book publishing and lots of opportunities. But in a way, it was sharing my own very personal story, being raised by a Cuban man and an Irish-American woman. One of my friends calls me a leprechauno, a mix of the two cultures. I was ashamed of my culture, my heritage, both sides of it, and kids would make fun of me for speaking Spanish and the fact that my dad had this accent and my mom had this Boston accent. And, I was a sensitive kid, but it was still, I didn't want to be different. And I told my dad, I don't want to speak Spanish. And he said his whole side of the family didn't speak any English. I was missing a great opportunity to be able to just connect with my family. And so my very first story is basically that, just telling the kids, look, I gave up speaking Spanish, but my family helped me reclaim it. And now that I have this love of both cultures and the both languages, I have this career where I get to tell stories about growing up in these two cultures. So it's been a really interesting journey for me. It wasn't too long before I started doing national festivals where people would see me in other spots and ask me to go around the country. And I have been all over the country and in 13 different countries as well, being able to share the stories. And part of it is people need to hear the stories that I'm saying, which is our cultures, our cultural backgrounds are worth celebrating and preserving. And there's an old joke I hear whenever I go to Europe, which is, what do you call someone who speaks three languages? Trilingual. What do you call someone who speaks two languages? Bilingual. What do you call someone who speaks one language? American. And, they love telling me that story. And in some ways, it's sadly true. There's part of the melting pot, and you have to learn about this culture. But also, when you give up that language, you're losing something really important.
Yeah, yeah. Antonio, how do you measure the power of a good story?
Wow. So it's funny. It's hard. We're doing this, on the phone. It's seeing the people that are looking at you, right? And they're listening, you can tell that that's happening. But also what happens, and this is what sets storytelling apart from all the other beautiful art forms that I love, TV and film and dance even. The listener is listening to the story, but is simultaneously creating and remembering their own stories. Mm-hmm. So when I talk about my very specific Cuban grandmother who lived on 8th Street and Little Havana in Miami, people are simultaneously thinking about their Italian grandmother or their Scottish grandmother or their German grandmother. And even though the specifics are different, the memory's the same. Mm-hmm. This ties in with some of the work that, your brain is just so much more active telling stories. And so there's sort of, you can see these things happening. You can see the audience listening to my story, but I can also almost see them creating their own stories.
Yeah.
And then that's my favorite compliment afterwards is to say, oh, you reminded me of my uncle that I haven't thought about. I can't wait to go home and tell my family about my uncle. And so this is the power of that medium. And, you can see a lot of times I'm at schools where teachers are on their cell phones, right? And they have to do the things they need to do. But then you see them turning the cell phones around and looking up, and then people just get drawn in. Mm-hmm. Something so mm-hmm. simple and so mm-hmm. powerful that just a man or a woman or even a child just speaking, telling a story, and seeing that connection. It's funny, I love theater, but even the first theater that I did with the puppet theater, all of the bells and whistles and the sets and lights and music, yeah. and you just strip it all down, and it's just the story. It's the story that's coming through.
Mm. Yeah, I can tell you're passionate about what you do.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, yeah. And talk about, you kind of alluded to this, but how storytelling can really unite us. When you shared just briefly, though, about storytelling, I couldn't help but think of one of my favorite teachers who actually died in 1998. And he was known as a speaker and a teacher, Dr. Leo Buscali. He wrote a lot of books on love. But what people, I think, were drawn to him for was in those teachings on love, he would tell his stories growing up with mama and papa and an Italian family. It was the stories that drew people in. I just now made the connection.
Oh, that's funny. Well, I mean, in some sense, what you're doing is that in your podcast and your radio shows, you're just trying to get at these stories. And it's kind of where we all connect. Like not everybody understands the things that you're necessarily bringing in, the guests you're bringing in. I've listened to your podcast the last couple of weeks as I've been thinking about this, and you have some amazing people with just years and years of expertise and practice. But what we all, where do we connect? We all connect at that very sort of personal level, and I think in some ways, there's a teacher of mine that I had in Chicago. She said that you try to make the audience laugh so that they can open up their mouths and you can reach in and touch their hearts. And I think in some ways, I love that. I travel because I do, humor is important to me, especially with little kids. But I think story is that same sort of thing. You get the people to sort of, open up themselves a little bit and just to connect with you, even if it's very different. Mm-hmm. And then you can reach in and give whatever message it is that you want to talk about or lesson you want to, teach.
Yeah, what I love about you is your creativity. Just getting on your website, you're spinning this beautiful art of storytelling that you do so well in so many different projects. You mentioned books. You've got quite a few written now. The one that I read is My Name is Cool, 18 Stories from a Cuban-Irish-American Storyteller. Where do you come up with all the stories?
You know what? I'm doing a lot of work working with kids of all ages, even all into college level, and just how to write. And really, personally, as much as I love reading fiction and amazing nonfiction, I'm also a big self-help book reader. I love self-help books. My own stories just come from the people I know and the places I've been.
Yeah.
And what's so powerful about that is every single kid I meet, from the five-year-old yesterday in Wyoming where I was to, the high school kid that I'll talk to tomorrow here in Los Angeles, they all know somebody and they've all been somewhere. Not everyone can go on a retreat to India. Not everyone can spend time studying, whatever it is. But all of us know somebody. And so I am just sort of an example of that. So, the 18 stories of a Cuban-Irish-American storyteller, 12 of them are about people in my family. Here's a story about my uncle teaching us how to swim. Here's a story about me and my brother fighting. Who hasn't fought with a sibling? Here's a story of my grandmother telling me an old story about, that she heard in Cuba. Who doesn't have an old person in their family that knows these old stories? So part of me really, really wants to impress upon children that they can write their own stories. Mm-hmm. And simultaneously, parents, that you can tell stories. I saw this last night. I'm sure you've seen this. There's three generations of people sitting at a table at dinner, and they all had their phones. and they're all looking at their phones, and maybe there's something really important. Maybe they're, who knows what they're sharing, but I'm like, this is a wasted opportunity. That grandfather, he looked healthy. How long is he going to be around? How many more dinners like that are those three generations going to get? And so, part of me is like, who have we forgotten about? Who are those early, teachers or coaches or friends or, who are these people? And that those stories can be powerful. Not everyone is publishable, but
sure.
I was looking at some of the work you did. You do in hospice, even. This is, in some ways, it's keeping them. I'm now of an age that some of the elders are now dying, and so
yes.
How do we keep them alive?
Yes,
by the stories that we tell from them.
Yes.
So this is a huge part of what I do.
So stories can create emotional journeys that really make us want to act, correct?
Yes, I think so. I mean, one of the really powerful stories I grew up with was just my family's immigrant stories on mm-hmm. both sides. Mm-hmm. You know, it was my mom's great grandparents mm-hmm. who came from Ireland, but mm-hmm. it was my dad and his family who came from Cuba. Mm-hmm. And you know, it's funny. I would try to complain to my dad about whatever I would complain about, and he's like, "Well, mijo, it's not like you came here with nothing, not even the language." You know what I mean? So, in some ways, that story, that immigrant story, became, oh, well, wait a minute. Yeah, this thing is hard, mm-hmm. but my family has survived harder, and I'm going to get through this.
Mm.
And that's been really kind of amazing.
You speak to a variety of groups, adults. You mentioned youth. Is there a favorite niche for you in terms of age group that you've just really, really enjoyed? Or
yeah, it's interesting. So when I first started, I mean, most schools usually think of storytelling, if they do, at the kindergarten through fifth grade level. Mm-hmm. So I've had the most experience speaking with those kids, and there's a silliness there and an openness there, mm-hmm. and a real joy and a delight there. They're also at the age where either they haven't heard the stories because they're too young, or sadly, they're just not exposed to the stories. So I can even tell the Three Little Pigs story, which I think everybody in the world would know, and it's yeah. still new to some kids.
Yeah.
And then junior high is really amazing, that you know, that really awkward, you know, pre-adolescent age, because they want to be too cool to listen, and then to see them hooked into the story within 5 or 10 minutes is really satisfying. And now I'm an adult. I have two children. You know, there's a lot of stories I have. I love speaking with parents. You know, I see the other side of it. You know, mm-hmm. I definitely, when I speak with parents, I want them to tell more stories to their kids. But I also know that it's hard to get dinner on the table, and it's hard to just get them kids out the door and half clean clothes. You know, so
yes.
I have a greater understanding now than I did before, and I love talking to parents and saying, "Look, I know that it's hard, and I know what you're going through, and I also know you have time in a day to bring up a memory of an old family member. You can shut off the DVD in the car. Mm. You can have a screen-free dinner, and you can talk about these things." So, yeah, the short answer is, you know, I when I first got started, it would just be whoever would have me is what I would love to tell stories, but along the way, I've been exposed and you know, had the great privilege to speak with all kinds of groups, you know, mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. really old people. I've been a lot of juvenile detention centers. That's mm-hmm. really powerful to be there.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have a favorite. Yeah. You know, as a matter of fact, I did a bunch of shows in Wyoming this week, and I was able to see different groups all the time. And that there's, you know, it's either the same story is told differently for different ages, or I have completely different stories for the different ages.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm at that point where it's hard to come up with a favorite group. Usually, you know, hopefully I can get to that place where my favorite group is the group that I'm in front of.
I love that. I love that.
Try to get to that point.
Yeah, yeah, when I was thinking and doing some research on this conversation with you, I was looking forward to it. I came across one of those story people visuals. I think Gabriel Andreas is the creator of that. But this one said, "Imagine a world where we listen to everyone's stories and learn that we're not as different as we are the same." That's what you're about, isn't it?
It is. It is. I think that there's something great about that. It's funny. It's been 30 years, and the topic or the conversation about language and immigration and multiculturalism has come and gone in different ways, and some exciting and some really disturbing, right? And mm-hmm. one of my favorite things to do is to, you know, tell, I definitely learn about as many cultures as I can, but I have a you know, I study Mexican and South American, Central American, Caribbean cultures, and I always try to come up with folktales. And, you know, when we're all laughing at a folktale that is so specifically cultural, but we all love that character or we mm-hmm. all know that lesson, it brings us all together for a moment, and I think that there's something really, really important about that.
Wow, you're getting my creative juices going. I mean, there's so many ways you could spin this. I was thinking many years ago, I don't know if it's still there, there was a peacemaking community on the northern coast of Ireland called Corrie Mela, and what Corrie Mela was about is bringing young people, young teenagers, Catholics and Protestants, back when the fighting was really big, not so much now, and
right.
bringing them together to learn more about the commonalities. And I'm thinking, what better way to do that than storytelling? And I don't know if they were doing that or not, but I'm just now thinking about all these things.
You know, wherever there's been conflict, there's been storytellers trying to help it out. There's some storytellers trying to do the same thing with the Israeli and Palestine situation, and then mm-hmm. there's plenty of American Indian storytellers. You know, there's all kinds of things that are happening. And yeah, I mean, it's, you know, in some ways, it's the simplest solution when you don't know what else to do. You know, I mean, there's some of these problems are so intractable and so big. Well, what happens if we just talk a little bit about it and listen? That's the part about the storytelling too. And that's kind of the thing that I miss the most as I'm brought into a place to be the storyteller. I'm not able to listen as much to the stories that are happening.
Yeah.
I can sense that I'm starting the conversation and then I have to leave, or I'm going to another place, or thankfully coming back to my home with my own family. And I think that's something that's, you know, that deep listening that happens that starts to awaken empathy. And that's something that can be transformative, mm-hmm. and has mm-hmm. been in the past. And,
yeah.
and I think we forget that.
Yeah. You're also a storyteller in residence at the UCLA Lab School. That sounds like a pretty heady and a really cool gig to get. Can you share more about that and what you're doing there?
Yes, it's funny. I was listening to one of your programs earlier about the work that you have to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so, I've always years ago somebody said, "Can you come and tell stories to this class for for free?" I'm like, "I don't know." And it turned out to be the lab school. And what has happened is they were the first school 10 years ago that really showed me the research that storytelling helps the kids read and write better.
Mm-hmm.
And so they've had a storyteller in residence for 30 years. I've been the one for the last 10. And the storyteller before sort of established the tradition. And really, it's really, they just want me to come in and tell whatever stories I'm working on, personal stories, folk tales, cultural stories, myths, fairy tales, whatever it is I'm doing, I just tell the stories to the kids. And then those teachers there help sort of show me how it fits into what they're doing. And that has been, it's been just a happy accident. I've been there about, once a week through much of the school year from, the last 10 years.
Yeah.
And it has become a really huge thing for me. It's a special spot. The school is as diverse as the state of California. So we have, pretty much every language that you can imagine. It's socioeconomically diverse. There are movie star kids all the way down to kids taking 3 buses to get there.
Mm.
The teachers are really amazing. And part of me thinks it's a shame. Every school should be like that, and that's not necessarily possible, But it's been a laboratory for me. It's 2 years ago they, for whatever reason, they said study the Grimm fairy tales, and I read all 200 of the fairy tales, and I told 20 of them in the school, and I told them the original way, and the kids still remember it.
I bet they do.
So yeah, so that's been a great blessing for me to be able to be at that school, and then I take what I learned from there into the other schools. I do a lot of work in Southern California here, and
uh-huh.
I'm able to sort of bring some of that out into the bigger community as well.
You've talked about the thrill it's been for you to be in the schools. There's going to be teachers listening to this, especially since we podcast all around the world. How can teachers from pre-K on contribute to their students through storytelling themselves?
Wow. So there's one thing that I heard earlier is that storytelling is a folk art. It's not a fine art, meaning we do it. And like I said, you do it when you go home and you tell your husband or your wife or your partner, what the traffic was bad and this is what happened.
Mm-hmm.
If I were an opera singer, I'm not going to say, "Hey, everyone, go spend 30 years learning how to perfect your voice and sing opera to your kids," as great as that would be for them. But I guess I want teachers to realize, and same for parents, the power of their own stories, right? So who were those, if she's a kindergarten teacher, if he's a third grade teacher, who were your third grade, who was the third grade bully? Maybe you were the third grade bully. Who was the third grade star? Who was, what are some of the sayings you grew up with? What are some crazy traditions you had? My grandmother used to put vapor rub on everything. If you had a skin knee or if you had, just a vapor rub came out, sunburn, vapor rub. And so that, if you share the specifics of that, it gets the kids thinking about it. It makes it easier for the kids to think of themselves as writers.
Yeah.
And then the other thing that happens is many people say, "Oh yeah, well I am a typical American. I have 5 different cultures, and all my grandparents came from 4 different places." Well, the library has got those folktales. If you mm-hmm. haven't, just go to the library and get a folktale and bring that folktale in and share it with your students. I my wife is a teacher, and she's crammed with all the different things she has to do and state mandates and tests and all these things. And so, while you're in transition, can you tell a little story about your favorite cousin, the time that you lost your keys, a lesson that you remembered.
Yeah.
You know, it's you're not creating, you're not sculpting marble, you're not dancing on point, you're not singing opera, you're just sharing a little bit of your history. And, you know, I've seen enough examples of this. The kids are going to remember those stories more than they're going to remember the specific lessons that they're being taught. In fact, I think it's a Maya Angelou quote of they'll remember how you made them feel, not what you said.
Absolutely.
And when kids are being told stories or even given the opportunity to tell their own stories in the classroom, they feel special. They feel acknowledged and heard. And I think that's we all want that for our kids, our own kids, kids in school, or, you know, even if you're not a parent, you want kids to have that experience. And I think teachers can model that in an easy way. You know, there are people who are, you know, actors and comedians. They don't have to be funny. They just have to be real. Mm-hmm. You just have to just say a little bit about what's going on. You know, small example, I just remember in kindergarten when I saw my kindergarten teacher at the grocery store and the shock that she was shopped. Oh, my gosh, what are you doing? You're shopping. I can't believe it. You know, that you have a life outside of teaching. Is something that I think is really powerful for kids.
One of the things that I've always been intrigued about with death, or why awareness of death is a secret of life, what I call it, is that we all have it in common. And that's what you're weaving so brilliantly through the stories that you're telling. I mean, I can't help but wonder what it would be like if we could just release you to our Congress and bring our Republicans and Democrats together on the same page through frickin' storytelling. Come on. That might be your toughest gig, though. So
that would be a tough gig. I'd rather go to the seventh graders who are too cool for anything.
Yeah, I got to wonder, because you're a storyteller and so good at that, and you have these beautiful two children, what's it like being at your family dinner table?
Oh, you know, it's funny. So part of it is my kids I've dragged them to enough storytelling events that they know all my stories. and I've also learned enough to, like one of my earlier teachers said, you know, just be quiet and listen. And so, you know, there's a lot of just, you know, what's going on and trying to create the space where they can speak. And I think that's a big thing about the devices. Again, I don't want to sound like a Luddite, but if they're even on the table, it's hard to, you know what I mean? Like there's a lot of silence at our table. We're just waiting. We ask a question and we wait, you know, and we try to really understand what it is. My daughter's seven, so there are things she can't say. She's still learning the vocabulary, so she's searching for things, and all of us kind of wait for her to get to her point. I mean, it's funny. It's a storytelling hazard when you look at a bunch of young kids and you ask a question, and the girl's like, oh, yeah, I've got a truck, and my dad, wait, and then, and my uncle, and the story just doesn't go anywhere, and you don't want to be like, quiet, kid, I'm the one up here, you know what I mean? Like, and so, but at my table, that happens, right? At our table, we let that time happen, and she feels heard, and then, you know, so, but that's part of it.
Do you have advice for anyone who might want to be a storyteller?
So the one thing I would say is this is, okay, you have your own audience is your family. Mm-hmm. So first of all, I would think, who are the people in your family that need to be listened to? Mm-hmm. Right. And this goes a little bit to hospice. My mom died last year and, you know, we just sat with her as much as we possibly could, right? Because now there's an end to it. I mean, we all know there's an end, but when you know that there's an actual end, it becomes really important. You know, and so, you know, who are those people that, maybe they're not sick, but my dad is 83. He's super healthy. He's strong. He's got all his wits about him. He walks 5 miles a day. And it seems to me that he's going to live forever. So he's just always going to be there. But is that true? No, that's not true. You know, and so I try to, even on my just normal conversations with him, I check in with him, you know, two or three times a week.
Yeah.
You know, we talk about the weather and baseball. He loves baseball. And I always try to get a little something about, you know, the stories that are going to be gone when he's gone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, his uncles and aunts that I never met that died before I was born. I'm pulling out those stories. So that's one thing I would say. The second thing I would say is then, you know, the courage to just share those stories. You know, look, we can't compete with the iPad and these amazing video games that these kids are playing. These games, I mean, you know, when I was a kid, it was Pong, which was one little, you know, ball that went across. You know what I mean? Like, you'd play for a minute, you'd be bored. You have to go outside and play.
Yeah,
these
kids
are never going to get bored. There's a million songs. There's a million videos. There's a million video games. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so a parent, you know, again, I have practiced my craft for many years, mm-hmm. but a parent doesn't have to practice the craft many years. I mean, in some ways, like, just ask the kid to turn that device off. Let me just tell you something. And it's going to be rough, and it's not going to be awesome, and the mm-hmm. stories aren't going to always have a point, and they're not mm-hmm. going to be beautiful or amazing, but there's that conversation. You know, I grew up watching TV with my mom, love watching TV. I can't remember one episode of one sitcom, but I can remember the stories that she told me about her childhood in Boston and what it was like when she was a kid. And those are the moments I wish I had back. You know, I don't know, TV is important to decompress, but I feel like what happens if you just start to share these stories that you're gathering, that you're sharing with.
Yes.
And then remembering that our kids have stories to tell us. You know, they're living this life, especially when they get into school. Much of it you're not privy to. And so you have to be an investigator and find out who are they sitting with and what are they playing with and what's happening and what did they learn and how. Mm-hmm. Not just how was your day, it was mm-hmm. who did something that was funny today? What happened when someone got hurt? Who helped her? Did anyone scrape their knee today? You know, like specific questions to try to get them to talk and then giving them the time to listen.
I heard that you're going to be offering classes online for teachers and possibly others. Is there a way for my audience to get more information on that?
That's sweet of you to ask. Yes, on my website is myname.com, which is antoniosacri.com. What I've realized, there's two things. When I first started as a storyteller, I couldn't wait to tour. And then I ended up touring 45 states and 13 countries. I've been all over the world. And then when I met my wife and we were talking about kids, I didn't want to tour and be away from them. I didn't want to miss that.
Yeah.
And so now I'm touring much less. I did 10 days this year instead of the 250 days I did the year before my son was born. And so, you know, now the technology, back to the flip side of technology, the technology has caught up that I can do a live stream event from a small theater here in Los Angeles and teachers from around the country can join in and can take a storytelling, you know, seminar with me, or they can, I can Skype into classrooms around the country, which is what I've done. And on my website, you can get, there's a way to get, email me or to get information about the live stream event itself. And that's a way for me to, you know, and so as you know, with your radio show and your podcast, you're reaching way more people than are going to tune in on any time.
Yes. Yes.
And that's the really powerful thing about the technology that we have. As much as I've been saying, put the phone down, this is a way to reach out. You know, my kids can FaceTime with their grandparents that live in three different states. I had to see my grandmother, you know, twice a year in Miami, and and it cost money to call her on the phone. Do you remember those days?
Yes.
The long distance bill would come, and Dad would be like, "No more calls," you know. And now that's not an issue. They can see their grandmother's face on our phone, and they can be there with her. And so, you know, this kind of technology is really amazing. So anyway, thank you for asking about how they can reach me through my website, and I have albums that people can. It used to be cassettes. I'm so old that I had cassettes. I would sell cassettes after my gigs, and then I sold CDs, and now people just want them online. And all my albums are online now on iTunes and all the places where people get stories. My storytelling albums are there as well.
Yeah, and speaking of
I just want to say, and the local library, your local library has my books. So
awesome.
That would, you know, in Indianapolis and pretty much 45 of the 50 states I've been, the libraries have my books. So they can get my books for free at the library.
And you have a YouTube channel, too.
I do. You know, so over the years, schools have, it's funny because they use basically schools have just videotaped me telling stories at the assemblies and then put them onto my YouTube channel. And a lot of schools are viewing those stories. And it's funny, there's definitely a little something that is really kind of amazing about that. I just, yesterday at the school, the kids had seen some of the stories on YouTube, It's funny, because when I was a kid, if you were on TV, you were a star, and if you were not, then it wasn't. Now these kids don't really see a difference between TV or YouTube. So I walked into the classroom yesterday, and the kid's like, oh, that's the guy from YouTube, which was really kind of funny for me, because it's just me telling stories at a school.
Uh-huh.
It's something I've
uh-huh.
done for years, but
yeah.
it really matters to these kids somehow. But back to the fact that they can see the stories or share their stories even when I'm not there, and there's something really amazing about that.
Well, you never know, Antonio. That's how Justin Bieber got his start. So we might be seeing you on all kinds of TV programs. Keep at it, my friend. I love what you're doing. You are so gifted at it. I can tell it also gives you great joy. So that could be another topic about how to find your passion and purpose in life. But I certainly appreciate you sharing your time with me and my listeners. And thank you so much for the joy and the light and the love that you're sharing throughout this world.
Richard, I really appreciate that and love being able to talk with your audience. And also the work that you're doing is just so beautiful and empowering. And I'm really lucky to be a small part of that. So thank you for the work that you're doing as well.
I want to encourage you to visit his website again. That is Antonio Sacre, SACRE.com. And that is today's program. I'm grateful that you joined us today, and I want to thank my engineer, Kylan Talley, and production coordinator, Angel Richardson, for helping to make this possible. You've been listening to Journey's Fire, inspiring the fire within you, one broadcast at a time.